Thanks for tuning in to Cross Defense This Day, the program where we do the biblical thing of helping all the body of Christ to do apologetics. You know, Peter talks about it in his first letter, chapter 3. We should always be prepared to give an apologia, a defense of the hope that's within us, Jesus Christ our Lord. So that's what we do here on Cross Defense. We give a shout out to our gracious underwriter, Luther Academy. Check them out, lutheracademy.com, doing great things around the globe for the Church of Jesus Christ, including publications, some excellent ones already out, and many more in the wings ready to hit your bookshelves. For instance, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, 12 volumes with 6 already published, and one more on the way on the Holy Trinity, as well as what I'm looking for, the upcoming collective works of Professor Kurt Marquardt, great Christian man. I took some classes with him, taught at our beloved Fort Wayne Seminary, just an outstanding Christian. And that a volume of that is just about ready to hit the streets, as well as they publish proceedings from some of their conferences. They've got their annual Congress on the Lutheran Confessions, which they have many publications already out there on, coming up in early April. Registration is now open for that Congress. It'll be at the Mall of America there in suburbia Minneapolis, Minnesota, as well as they publish Logia, that excellent journal of Lutheran theology. Well, for all of you who don't understand apologetics, we've got a program for you today. I'm talking about apologetics for those of you that are not pastors, are not trained at a seminary or a college or somewhere on apologetics, but are interested, or even if you're not, you should be interested. So we've got a brand new book that we want to share with you and its author, Apollo What? Christian Apologetics for the Garden Variety Pew Sitter, written by our guest, Adam Neubauer. Welcome to Cross Defense, Adam.
Thanks, Rod. It's a pleasure to be here. Big fan of the show, so thank you for your program.
Great, great. Well, we love doing it because there's so many of us that have really, you know, observed correctly that apologetics is biblical, it's Christian, and we should all be doing it. And I pray to God, Adam, that your book is a big help to a lot of people out there because it's written for so many at that level. So let's begin with this. Why don't you share with our listeners some of your background and how you came to be interested in apologetics and to write this book?
Absolutely. So I don't practice apologetics in a professional environment. I don't get paid to do debates or speak at any local congregations or anything like that. I do have a bachelor's in history with an emphasis on religion. So I was trained a little bit in that aspect of it, the historical method. But to be honest, I've been interested in apologetics since I was a little boy in church. There was a sermon, I must have been 6 years old, and the pastor had mentioned about the women as the first witnesses at the vacant tomb. And he went through that line of reasoning, which maybe we can discuss later in the program, but it sparked my interest in having an actual reason for our faith, for the fact that Christianity is true. So that was my first exposure to apologetics, even though I didn't actually know that it was apologetics, if that makes sense. So I've been interested for a long time.
Now, have you yourself taken any classes or anything, Adam, to bone up on this, or just almost your self-study?
I would say more self-study from an official angle of apologetics, but I've been able to piece together apologetics arguments using my formal education because, as I mentioned, I was a history major and a philosophy minor. So philosophy is kind of the underpinning of the apologetics method, and then the historical method goes a long way to helping, because you're at some point you have to analyze the New Testament documents for what they are, and that's a historical approach.
Excellent. Well, I think if memory serves me right, I've been doing this program for a couple of years now, and I've talked to some great apologists in the world. One of my heroes, not only in apologetics, but just in theology, Dr. Alistair McGrath. I was blessed to worship him in person, and some others. And you know, when I ask him this question, Adam, they all answer differently. When I ask them, define apologetics and your understanding, how would you do that? How would you define apologetics?
Well, the word apologetics derives from a Greek word, apologia, and that translates into English as verbal defense. And where we get that word, we see it in the New Testament book of 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, where Peter instructs Christians to always be prepared to give a verbal defense for the hope that we have in us. And that is specifically speaking about Christianity. So in short, the way I explain it is Christian apologetics is the act of presenting a positive case that Christianity is true and then defending objections against it. And we do that just like any other way that you would try to prove that something is true. You do it through the evidence. And that's something I'm sure we'll talk about as this show goes on.
Absolutely. I like that kind of a two-parter, present in a positive way the case for Christianity, and then meet all the challengers. You know, first class I ever took on apologetics was in seminary, just a great professor, and I loved his definition. I've never heard anybody else use it. He liked to think of apologetics as intellectual slum clearance. You know, it's like you've built a project for the people that need housing, and it gets run down so bad that you just have to bring in the bulldozers and just, you know, tear the thing down and start over. And I kind of like that, you know, we knock down all the obstacles intellectually so that the gospel might have a chance to be planted. And I really like that. Now, your book talks about this apologetics, Adam, being for the garden variety pew setter, which when I first saw this, I thought this could be really good. And then when I got the book and read it, I really liked it. And before I forget, let's ask you this. How can our listeners get a hold of this book?
Absolutely. So the best way is just to go on Amazon and just type my name in the search bar, Adam Neubauer. That's Neubauer. And you can type that in Amazon, and the book will just come up as the first choice. And you can buy it on paperback or digital format through Kindle as well.
Wonderful. And, you know, that's such a convenient way for so many of us to buy it. A lot of us, you know, buy stuff through them. Already have an account. They have pretty good pricing, ship stuff right out. So I'll tell you what, too, as is our custom here on Cross Defense, Adam, on the archive of this show, we will put a link, a direct link, where people can just hit on that. It'll take them right there to Adam Amazon, and they can purchase, hopefully, lots of copies for them and for their friends. So let's define the second part of your book. How do you define, what do you mean by a pew setter?
That's a great question. So the first time I heard the word, I was actually in the narthex of my church, and I kind of overheard a couple other folks talking about it, and they mentioned the word, and I was able to kind of weasel my way into the conversation and ask what that actually meant. I thought I had an idea, and I was somewhat right. It's somebody that goes to church, attends service every week or almost every week, maybe goes to Bible study, and maybe is involved in some other aspect of the church, an usher on a committee of some sort, but isn't trained in theology formally. They haven't been to seminary. They might be college educated, but not in theology, not in any religious aspect. And if you think about it, that's the majority of people. That's the majority of the church is lay people. And we are the ones that, because of the sheer numbers, outweigh that of the clergy. We're probably going to have more opportunities to engage in apologetics than the clergy just because of the sheer numbers. We have more members of the laity. So this book is tailored for somebody who does not have a degree in theology or even philosophy or history or the components that would really drive an expert apologist conversation. This book is meant so that they can have an introduction to the material and just a high-level mastery so they can give reasons for their faith and present a positive case that Christianity is true.
Not only, as you say it, that their derrieres are in the pews, and there's many more of them than the clergy, but I would offer up, Adam, that in my experience, a lot of people are reluctant to talk about theology, let alone apologetics, with us pastor types. You know, I've seen people. You watch their facial expressions, their body language when they find out you're a pastor, and right away a lot of them kind of close up. You know, some of them will talk to you, but I think a lot of them feel like I'm not gonna talk to this person. I think they're more likely to talk with the pew setters. I really do. So I think this is a good thing that you're doing here. I commend you on that, and I commend your book to all people. It's very well done. Now,
thanks.
Adam,
that's a great point. Yeah,
there are generally speaking known to be a lot of different styles or methods of apologetics. There are even some great books out there that if anybody wants to find those, get a hold of me, and I'd be glad to share a couple that I really find valuable. We call those three evidentiary, presuppositionalist, and classical. Does your book really cover all three, or do you kind of hone in on one of them?
So what I would do is first talk about the presuppositionalist approach. And the reason I'll talk about that a little bit first is because I don't really talk about that in the book. I allude to it very briefly. And what that is they presuppose that the Bible is divine revelation, and then they progress from there. So a Christian apologist will say the Bible is true. That's their starting point. And to me, that's technically a logical fallacy known as begging the question, which is a form of circular reasoning. And that's because the conclusion that you're trying to prove, which is Christianity is true, that conclusion is embedded. It's hidden in one of the premises. In other words, the first premise is the Bible is true. So it's arguing in a circle, essentially. So the presuppositionalist approach, I think that's okay when you're doing something called polemics. And polemics is a sister discipline to apologetics, something I call intra-Christian apologetics, where us Christians are kind of having an in-house debate. So, for example, communion. Do we regard communion as the real body and real blood? Well, we can have that conversation in-house as Christians and start from a point of agreement that the Bible is true, and then we can progress from there. So I think that's where the presuppositionalist method will come into play the most. But my book blends the classical apologetic method and evidentiary apologetics. And the methodology itself, I would say, is more of a classical approach, because it follows a linear stream. I attempt to prove in succession that truth exists and that a theistic God exists, and then that miracles are possible, and then that the New Testament is true. So that in that stream, if you follow it, it cumulatively proves that Christianity is true. And that sort of stream has been followed by many apologists over the course of history. Even if you think about it, Paul the Apostle himself, when he was arguing with the Greeks and the Romans, he started from a point of inescapable realities. of creation and conscience that everyone has access to. In other words, what we call natural revelation. He started from there, and then he argued with them. Argued is kind of is a term that has a negative connotation, but really all it means is trying to prove that something is true or false. And then he would progress to prove that Jesus rose from the dead, which then is where evidentiary apologetics comes into play. That's where we rely on miracles and prophecy as evidence of God's existence and his identity. And obviously the central tenet, the central evidence, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So the best way to illustrate that is through proving the New Testament is true, because in those documents of the New Testament, there's eyewitness testimony that it proves beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus rose from the dead. And so I actually allocate four chapters of my book to that specific question: is the New Testament true? So the linear model is classic apologetics. It was developed coherent method by Dr. Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. So it's out there. I think it's just the easiest framework to follow. But for the purposes of the pew sitter, we really don't have to know about the distinctions and methods as names. That's not absolutely critical, because we're just trying to make a case that Christianity is true and respond to objections against it.
Very good. When I interviewed Dr. McGrath, I asked him a similar type question that I just asked you about, you know, the different methods. And I kind of knew ahead of time. I read enough of his stuff and was talking to him about, I think, one of his latest books on apologetics, Mirror Apologetics. And, you know, he said something fascinating, Adam, that I think you kind of, you know, said you incorporated into your book, was that, you know, he felt that the different methods were different tools that he could put in his apologetics toolbook and use them wherever he could, depending on the circumstance and the individual. And I kind of like that. You know, I couldn't see a lot of situations where I might bring out the presuppositional method. But, you know, when I talked to him about that, you know, I remember him saying, well, you know, hey, look, What if there was a person that would, when you're talking, say, well, okay, I accept that the Bible is reliable, but I still don't, not convinced by the message. Well, there you go. Just take off, right? But so I thought that kind of fascinating that, you know, we can have an apologetics toolbox and we might not pull that one out much, but we know it and we have it available and use it when we can. So let's ask this important question, which I think your book does a very fine job of answering. Why should a Christian do apologetics? Why should a pew sitter, a garden variety pew sitter, do apologetics, Adam?
I think that's a very important question. It's actually the title of the first and last chapters of my book, just to reinforce the point that as a pew sitter, we're called to do more than go there on a Sunday, sit down in a pew, stand up when we're told to, and worship. Now, that's absolutely critical and essential, but that's not where it begins and ends being a Christian. And so let me first say that a Christian should not do apologetics to argue someone into faith. And what I mean by that is God alone can endow faith. We know that through his means of grace, the waters of baptism, the Lord's Supper, absolution, and, of course, his holy word as contained in the Bible. That is how you come to faith. Now, if God uses your apologetics process in what exactly how you and Alistair McGrath said, intellectual slum clearance, to open someone up to receiving the faith, then he can do that. You can't take any credit for it, but that's certainly one thing. So then why should a Christian do apologetics? Well, it's quite simple. God commands you to, and there's numerous scripture for that. We already talked about 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give a defense to the faith and the hope that's within you. 2 Corinthians 10 says, destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God. Jude says contend for the faith in chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1, Paul talks about defending and confirming the gospel. There's in Titus, Paul also talks about refuting those who contradict any sound doctrine. And then, of course, Jesus himself in Matthew 10 says that everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father in heaven. And we all the pew sitters are probably familiar with the greatest commandment, that you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. The fact that mind is embedded in there is important, that we have these intellectual faculties that we can engage God with. And of course, being salt and light to the world. The culture is going in a direction of agnosticism, if not outright atheism. We see in the Pew surveys the number of nones, N-O-N-E-S, nones, where they claim that they're religiously unaffiliated. That's going up. So to be salt and light, as Jesus said, what is salt without its taste? And what is a lamp if a basket is placed over it? We can't be salt and light if we refuse to defend Christianity on intellectual grounds, because that's usually where people try to tear it down.
And as you've stated, the number of these nones, N-O-N-E-S, they're increasing. And so there's ample opportunities out there for us to, defend the cross and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And, what I found, if we take that approach that you're recommending, Adam, that it's not about winning intellectual arguments or debates. It's about knocking down their false thoughts to, and I love your scripture references there also, because, many places in the Bible, it's saying the same thing, that we want to love that fellow human being that is being deceived, is being faked out by the lies to where, they say Christianity is not true. We want to, in a kind and gracious way, share with them that Christianity is really true. It's historical. It's you don't have to throw your mind, turn your mind off to be a Christian. In fact, people would all tell us, even Alistair McGrath, a great mind like his, my mind is more turned on now that I'm a Christian. So we don't have to check in our intelligence, our brain at the door, do we? At the opposite, exactly. It can be the most wonderful thing because we know that all logic and truth comes from God, doesn't it? So it's neat to be able to share this. And would you say, Adam, that the pew setter ought to be now kind of encouraged and willing and anxious, wanting to learn how to defend the Christian faith?
Absolutely, because logic, as you said, is on our side. In fact, John chapter 1, when he states that Jesus is the Word is translated as Logos, which is L-O-G-O-S, and that is where we get the word logic from. And that's where
let's cut you off there, because I've just been told we're going to have to take a break, and we'll pick that up on the other side of these messages. You're listening to Cross Defense with our guest, Adam Neubauer, written a new book, Apollo What? Christian Apologetics for the Garden Variety Pew Sitter. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
If someone told you the Bible doesn't teach infant baptism, how would you respond? Monday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller about the top three Bible passages for infant baptism. We'll also discuss the Oscar winners and losers with Pastor Ted Giese.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Missourians are celebrating something big this year, but there won't be a party to attend, and you won't see a parade down Main Street either. It probably won't even make the evening news. But 75 years ago, our citizens adopted Missouri's nonpartisan court plan to reduce politics and money in the selection of our judges. And for 75 years, it's made us a national leader. Now that's something to celebrate. To learn more, visit MissouriPlan.com. Paid for by the Missouri Bar. Sabrina Barrett, Executive Director.
Hi, this is Pastor Harrison. Let me tell you about something new and exciting. We call it Life Together, a monthly digital digest where I'll be sharing news and highlights from Synod publications and multimedia outlets. There'll be something for everyone. Each digest will be delivered to your inbox, showing how we live and work together to proclaim the gospel and bear Christ's mercy to one another in our congregations, communities, and the world. Please be sure to subscribe today. You'll be glad you did.
If you were asked the question whether you trust in Jesus all the time, how would you answer? I believe that most of us would answer, not always. Then how can we sing the hymn, I Trust, O Christ, in You Alone? With the help of Mark Smith, we will look at that on the next broadcast of Law and Gospel.
Weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
In a 2007 cover article on the Bible in public schools, Time magazine wrote, simply put, the Bible is the most influential book ever written.
Google the words, books that changed the world, and on list after list, you'll find the Bible, most often the King James Version of the Bible.
Did you know the King James Version of the Bible, authorized by King James I of England and printed in 1611, remains the most popular English translation of the Bible?
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
And did you know many American presidents have been sworn in with their hand on the King James Version of the Bible? Or that numerous phrases we hear every day,
eat, drink, and be merry,
he's the salt of the earth,
the writings on the wall,
are from the King James Version.
Once the King James Version became popular, it was the Bible primarily used in the English-speaking world for the next three centuries. Engage with the Bible, with this book for all time.
Brought to you by Museum of the Bible.
So glad you've chosen to stick with us here on Cross Defense. Rod Zwanitzer back with you, thanking our underwriter and encouraging you to do the same. Contact them, lutheracademy.com. You'll find out the information, how you can do that. Check out all the great things that they're doing for the Church of Jesus Christ. And then let them know how much you appreciate what they're doing, and especially underwriting one of your favorite programs on apologetics, Cross Defense. Today we're talking with apologetics for the Pew Center with Adam Neubauer. He's authored a new book, Apollo What? Christian Apologetics for the Garden Variety Pew Center. You can get a copy for yourself and for your other fellow Pew Setters and your pastor by getting hold of our link on the archive of the show, kfuo.org. The Cross Defense, you'll see that right there. Or you can just type in apologetics for the Pew Center, and this program will come up, and you'll find a link right where you can find that book, or you can check it out for yourself on Amazon.com. Just type in Adam Neubauer, N-E-U-B-A-U-E-R. Adam, we had to cut you off a little bit, and you were sharing some good stuff about logos. Why don't you pick it up there before we go on, please?
Okay, great. Yeah, so Logos is L-O-G-O-S, and it's actually the word, W-O-R-D, that you see in John 1, the first several verses, where he identifies as Jesus as the Word. And Logos is where we get our word, our English word, logic from. And it's also the suffix ology. That you see in biology, radiology, theology, and it means the study of. In other words, it means the being, the essence, and meaning itself. The pew sitter should not be afraid to use logic and reason when talking, because we have that on our side. That all reason and truth comes from Jesus, comes from God. So we have that on our side. And if you pray for opportunities to engage in apologetics, they will come. I promise that through God, obviously. And all of my experiences, when you're talking with people, very rarely will you, in fact, never in my experience, will they immediately just surrender and say, okay, now I believe Christianity is true. But it's encouraging because after each time that you speak with somebody, maybe the goal should be to an analogy I can use is if you ever had a haircut and, you know, for the rest of the day, if you don't take a shower, you kind of feel the itchiness or the hair on your back and your neck. And
you're really bothering me. I just got one before the program today. And I was telling my wife I had that itchiness around. So exactly. Most of us guys experience that quite often.
Right. And you know what I'm talking about. And so the analogy is that might be the goal is every conversation with a hardened atheist is to be like that where it itches at them that something you said was so irrefutably true. Maybe they couldn't admit it at that time, but then they'll come back for more until that itch is gone.
Excellent point. You know, I can remember, too, when I was a garden variety pew sitter before I went to seminary. I was living and working in Dallas, Texas, Adam, and they had one of the largest churches in the United States, First Baptist of Dallas, a real famous one, had its own radio station. And I remember on my lunch hour when I could, when I was in town, I would listen to Norman Geisler. And he talked about apologetics. And I remember him saying that how he got into it was he started talking with people about Christianity, and a lot of them would object. And he would not know the answer to their objection, but he would go and study and talk to people. And then he found out he knew more and more of some of the ways to counter their disagreements. And the point he was making, which really, you know, got me hooked, was he said, when I started out, I didn't know anything. But that did not stop me from wanting to share with people. And the more I shared, the more I would go and learn. And then the more I could talk. I think that's a really good incentive, because would you agree, Adam, that I think the devil kind of discourages a lot of us Christians from talking to non-believers about why our Christianity is logical and makes the most sense? It's the best worldview. Because a lot of people say, well, I don't know enough as you, Adam, or as Norm Geisler. So they won't even start. They won't even start to you know, find the answers or even dare to talk to anybody. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. The devil is the father of lies, and he has that ability to hurt your confidence before you even start, and then you don't want to start, and then he accomplished his mission. Lack of confidence should never be your reason for starting apologetics. As you kind of alluded to, it kind of builds on itself. As you take the first step, you'll notice that it makes more and more sense, and it leads to other questions that leads to more answers. And before you know it, people are coming to you for the advice. I think that's one of the tricks that the devil has to pull out, other than just confusing terms and changing definitions of words. He can stop you even before that and just hurt your confidence so you don't even want to start.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, the Lay's potato chips that bet you can't eat just one. And the devil says, you can't, don't even start to eat one because you'll never want any more. But what we're saying, and I think Norm Geisler is saying, if you do start out in apologetics, you're likely going to get hooked. And it's going to be a good hooking because you're going to want to know more and you're going to be able to share more with the unbelieving world around you. So let's ask this question before we get into some examples in your fine book, Adam. What outcome would you like the reader of this new book to walk away with after they've read it?
So I would like to maybe say what the overall goal is, to be a primer to the basic apologetics task. And if I can use another analogy here, I love analogies. C.S. Lewis, who was a master apologist, used analogies a lot, so I like using them as well. And the goal of the book is to apologetics is an acquired taste sometimes. You can't, some people get bogged down with the philosophy and the historical method and some of the scientific underpinnings of the Big Bang and things like that. So what I try to do with my book is do the term wet your palate to apologetics. And so I'm not a big seafood eater, so I can't just start eating caviar. A chef would recommend I start with something more properly basic, such as salmon or something like that, and then I could eat caviar. I'm eating seafood, but I just have a primer to it to wet my palate. So that's the overall goal of the book, give the pew sitters a framework to at least start the apologetics task. That being said, I'd like Christians to have a working knowledge of the material and at least be able to present a positive case that Christianity is true. And also there's four or five objections that just are repeated. I'll say regurgitated, actually, because most of the time the objector hasn't even examined what he's saying. And I deal with those directly in the book as well, because that's sometimes how the apologetics topic will arrive, is through an objection rather than having a chance to present the positive case.
I think that's such an important and frequent thing that you're sharing with us here, Adam. A lot of people will spout off something they've heard from someone else or media and all of that. And when you start to break that down and talk with them, you find out they don't even know what that objection really is. And so I think that's a really good point. If we could, with the remaining time, let's talk about a couple of the examples that you have in your book to whet that palate. First, this one I just pulled out because I think this is one that some of our people are going to hear frequently. I know I have, and I love discussing this with folks when they do. How can a loving God send someone to hell? How do you answer that in your book?
Right. So with any objection, sometimes it helps to ask a question before you even jump right into it. To get definition straight, because
and one guy calls it the Columbo method, using the famous detective on TV. Just one more question, I like that.
Right, because then that demonstrates to the person that you're actually listening and you're trying to figure out what they're talking about. But it's more effective to clear up definitions, because as I said, a pervasive problem, I actually think one of the root issues in society today, the devil is doing is he's changing definitions of words. And the law of identity states that a thing is a thing and not something else. And just fiddling with that law can go a long way to confusing people. So the question of hell, the first question I would ask is, what do you mean by hell? Because in the popular culture, what has been conjured up, images of hell, is the devil with hoofs and horns and a tail, stabbing you with a pitchfork in a cave. They have these images. So what I would do is say that's not actually a true illustration of hell. The devil will actually be the primary resident of hell. So get that out of your head. What I would say is that hell, if we define it properly, how Christians define it, would be separation from God's grace. And then heaven, conversely to that, is being in the glorious presence of God and having your will directed towards him and having what they call the beatific vision. And that's where you're in the very presence of God. So hell being the opposite of that is the absence of God's grace. So once you say, okay, hell is just the separation from God's grace. Now, why would God send me there? Well, God gives you what you want, ultimately. So if you go through your life and say, I want you to be my friend, and I invite you for a cup of coffee, talk, get to know you, you say no, I invite you to dinner maybe at my house, you say no, I invite you for a cookout, a swim in my pool, you say no, shouldn't I be getting the hint by now? But I still want to be your friend. So maybe it's time for my wedding where all of the attention will be directed towards me. And I invite you to my wedding and you still say no. Would it be loving for me to force you into that wedding where all the attention's focused on me? Should I bind you up and bring you into my presence? In fact, that would be the unloving thing to do. The loving thing to do would be to let you go your own way, to give you what you want. And that is what God essentially does by allowing someone to go to hell. He's separating them from his grace. He's letting them walk away, and he gives them what they want.
So what you're suggesting here is that God is always trying, constantly trying to get people to see the reality, the truth of the matter, that he loves them for eternity, and he's always reaching out to them to be in his presence, to be at peace with him, and humans, a lot of them, continually to reject that. That's almost like Jesus says right before Holy Week, looking over all of Jerusalem, you know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I've longed to gather you under my wings as a mother hen does her chicks. I'm always willing, but you constantly resist me, right? So
exactly.
Very biblical what you're saying here. Almost we could say that the loving God, he really doesn't send anybody to hell against their choice. It was their choice to not be in his presence. They never wanted to be in his presence.
Right. The presupposition was saying, why would a loving God send me to hell? The presupposition there is that no one wants to be in hell. And that's not true. People don't want to be in heaven. They do not want to be in the presence of God. And so that's what God grants them for eternity.
You know, there's so many different offshoots of this that you could go on to, and we don't want to bog down here so we can't get to somewhere you'll find examples. But, you know, one of the things the Bible does is it says that if humans could right this day know how wonderful heaven is and how terrible hell is to be separated from God for eternity, no one would want to go the hell route, but people get faked out, as you were saying, even to the realities of heaven and hell and how one ends up in those eternal places. And it's like the devil is so good at deceiving people, they don't even want to talk about it. I've tried to talk with some people about it. They don't even want to talk about it. I'm saying, my goodness, this is eternity we're talking about here. And they're like, I really don't care. You know,
right,
it's amazing,
right.
Isn't it?
Yes, yes. They suppress the truth and unrighteousness to go their own way, and God gives them up to their own desires. That's Romans.
Isn't that an amazing passage from Romans, that they suppress the truth? They don't want it to show its head in their conversation, in their lives. So that's what we Christian apologists want to do. We want to hopefully have those opportunities, and we pray for them, and your book helps us prepare for those. Let's talk about another one, Adam. the problem of suffering and evil, one that so many people will raise as an obstacle, an objection to the truth of Christianity. How do you in your book address that obstacle?
And that's probably the most common objection is, why does God allow evil, or why does God allow suffering? It's probably the most common objection. So if somebody was just going to grab my book and read just one chapter, maybe that would be the best chapter, because it is the most common. And again, I think you can start out by asking a question: what do you mean by suffering? Because the way I see it, there's two different kinds of suffering. One is suffering at the hands of another individual, and the other is kind of gratuitous suffering, where we don't really see a meaning. So the first one would be things like murder or robbery or kidnapping or Hitler's genocide, where another person perpetrated the evil or a terrorist attack. And the reason you draw that distinction is because that first one is actually fairly easy to answer. Suffering at the hands of another individual. So what God has done with people is he's given us free will for, between each other, because he wants us to love. Love thy neighbor as yourself. The only way to love your neighbor is if you do it freely. Love, can, by definition, cannot be forced. Otherwise, it's just compliance. So he had to give us free will in order to love each other. Now, with that, some people will choose of their own free will to perpetrate evil, and that causes suffering among another person, maybe. So that is really the root answer. There's a couple other ways that you can just throw out there as well, to kind of open someone's eyes and say, well, if God stopped all evil, then guess what? He'd have to stop me too, because I commit evil acts every day. They might not be as extreme and by worldly standards as something that Hitler did or a terrorist attack, but he'd have to stop me in my tracks too if he wanted to stop all evil. And then another more philosophical type of way to answer this, and I cover this in a chapter of my book as well, is that if God did not exist, you wouldn't even have an objective standard to call something evil or good. The objective standard of right and wrong is actually grounded in God's character. If it's not, then it's just a matter of opinion. So by saying why would God allow evil, they're presupposing that good and evil exist, and the only way it could exist is if God exists. So I realize that last part is a little convoluted, but I cover it in my book. So a good way to respond to the objection is the free will argument among people. If we need to love each other, that means we have to have free will, and some people will use free will for evil.
Mm. Yeah, and again, as we talked about the previous discussion on loving God, sending someone to hell, there's a lot of ways to approach and handle this objection. And it is a tough one. Where I think, you know, when I try to talk about this, I admit it right off the bat that this is a difficult one to talk about, because none of us really like suffering and evil, especially when we're in it, or we see someone we care about, or even we just see other humans and creation suffering this. But, a lot of people, when they realize that suffering and evil are short-term phenomena, and in the end, God's going to wipe them out, and in the heaven, they're not going to be existent, their ears are kind of perked up a little bit. They want to hear more about this if they haven't already heard it. And if they've heard it, then they want to talk about it, you know, maybe sometimes with the little argumentative spirit going on, which is good. But I really like this, that idea that God really, he doesn't like suffering and evil either. But we do know, and a lot of people will attest to this, he does use these a lot of times, doesn't he, to allow individuals to get closer to him, to realize, the old saying is, when you walk in a hospital bed, sometimes you have to tell people, God puts you flat on your back for weeks or months. So all you could do is look up at him and have him think about it a little bit more. He gives them a little more time to stop and think about what it's all about. And I guess we're talking perspective here, aren't we? And so we Christians, would you say, Adam, we bring a different and a true perspective to suffering and evil?
Right. Well, yeah, you're pretty good at this. Maybe you should be a radio host about it.
I do play one on the radio. Yes.
But exactly. So that's kind of this. I like to bring in that in the second evil that I mentioned, the natural suffering. So natural disasters, pediatric cancer, suffering that we really don't have an explanation for that exact suffering. So how I explain it is that we are stuck in this dimension of time, a linear path from beginning to end, from the day you're conceived to the day you die. And you cannot see anything outside of that limitation of time. But in the beginning chapters of my book, I explain how God exists outside of our definition of time. By outside, I mean independent. He's not confined. So he sees the big picture. He sees how our present suffering will be future joy. And the presupposition of why would God allow these bad occasions of suffering, that presupposes that every single occasion of suffering is bad. When as Christians, we know that bad will ultimately be worked for good through God in faith. So we are the only worldview that takes that approach, that even suffering can be a good thing.
And ultimately, the crucified one taking on the suffering for all of us that deserved it is the ultimate, part of that. Guys, we're running out of time, unfortunately, Adam, but give us about a minute of how you approach the origins of the universe before we have to say goodbye and wrap this up.
Okay, yeah, so that's a very big question, but what I'll say is don't be afraid of what you hear of as called the Big Bang, because the Big Bang is basically scientific evidence that we use as a premise in our argument to show that God exists, because God, there has to be a self-existent cause. The Big Bang is a definite point, a finite point in time where time itself was created and the universe itself was created. And in order for that to happen, something has to exist, and that something is God. And so basically the Big Bang is completely congruent with Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:3, where in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and God said, "Let there be light." That is completely congruent with the scientific evidence of a singular point of the universe and time coming into being. So that's just the quick elevator pitch, and maybe one day we can get into it some more.
Sure, love to do that. You'll find a lot more than what we've just shared here today in this fine book for you, the Garden Variety Pew Sitter. Apollo, what? Garden Variety Pew Sitters doing Christian apologetics with our guest, Adam Neubauer. Adam, it's been a real pleasure and joy. Thanks for the book. Thanks for being our guest. And we look forward to maybe having you back on to talk about both of our mutual loves and many of our listeners' apologetics.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'd love to.
Next week on Cross Defense, our good friend, the Reverend Sam Schultheis, who's going to talk about the apologetics of imagination with all of these movies out there, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and such, so much that we Christians can use by analogy and by offshoots, because as our guest today was talking about, C.S. Lewis was really into that. And we can too. So join us next week for that here on Cross Defense on Worldwide KFUO. Thanks for listening today.